Welcome back to the Environmental Law Monitor. I'm your host, Daniel Pope. This podcast is brought to you by Bracewell LLP's Environment, Lands, and Resources Practice Group, and it's a place for thoughtful conversations. We have conversations ranging from the latest developments to perennial topics like litigation, enforcement, and compliance assurance. We're glad you're spending some time with us today.
We're glad you're here with us, and I'm excited for you to meet our special guest today. We are joined by Amanda Glenn. She's the National Technical Director for Biological Services at SWCA. She is a friend of the firm, a friend of the podcast, and we are excited to have her on today to talk about a really interesting endangered species listing proposal. Welcome, Amanda.
Thank you, Daniel. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we're joined also by just the incomparable Ann Navarro, an endangered species expert in her own right, coming at it from the legal side. Welcome back, Ann.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So Amanda, Ann, on our topic today for our discussion, we are going to be picking up a conversation that we had last year in November. Amanda joined us at our environmental law seminar in Houston to discuss endangered species and natural resource issues. And we had a great time talking about a couple of blind catfish that have been proposed to be listed under the Endangered Species Act. Amanda, what can you tell us about the proposed listing, the fish that we're looking at, where they live, all of those great details?
Oh, these are two catfish species that are really pretty interesting. They live very deep in the aquifer underneath the city of San Antonio in Texas. They are adapted to that really deep environment by they lack eyes. They don't have any skin pigment. So if you were to hold one in your hand, it would be white or pink. I guess it was agitated and its blood was flowing real hard. Other than that, we don't know terribly much about them.
And these live in the Edwards Aquifer,
yes,
in the little nooks and crannies of the aquifer. I think I saw something, I was reading that they are 800 feet deep, 1,000 feet deep, maybe even deeper.
Yeah, it's about a quarter mile underground in cavernous parts of the aquifer under San Antonio. No human eyes have ever gazed upon that piece of the earth. It is deep underground.
So when you say that no human eyes have ever gazed at these nether reaches of the Edwards Aquifer, and yet these species have been proposed to be listed, and we'll talk a little bit more about the legal ramifications of a listing decision here in a little bit. We're just orienting ourselves. How in the world did anyone discover these blind catfish species? I mean, this is sort of like the definition of out of sight, out of mind, like Schrodinger's catfish, almost. Like, how do you know it's there? How did people learn about these endangered species? How did people become concerned? How do we even know that they are potentially endangered?
Well, so this part of the aquifer is under intense pressure. It's an artesian part of the aquifer. So the water just flows to the surface because of the pressure that that water is under. The first time anybody set eyes on one of these catfish, it came out of a groundwater well in, goodness, I think like the 1920 or thereabouts. Somebody had drilled a well into this highly pressurized aquifer system. Water starts coming out, and in that water came a catfish, small, about 3-4 inches, pink or white, and without eyes. It was of note, because not every time you drill a well, fish come out of it. So let alone white or pink fish. So it's been known since about 1920. Since that time, it has been found coming out of water from groundwater wells from about 11 different wells in San Antonio since about 1920. Some of those wells have both species in it, because there's two of them. One is called the toothless blind cat. The other is called the wide mouth blind cat.
Okay.
And they are notable when you find them.
So, Amanda, I'm just curious. I know, because I've, you know about the proposed listing and read it, that these particular blind catfish live only in the underground aquifer, but do they have relatives that live in deep caves where people might have observed similar fish? Or are these types of catfish only known to exist in aquifers deep underground?
These fish are only known out of wells that tap into the very deep part of the Edwards Aquifer, and just a very small slice of that aquifer, actually. So the wells where they've been found happen along what's called the bad water line in San Antonio. That's where you have saline groundwater from the east meets up with the fresh groundwater that comes out of kind of the western part of the Edwards Aquifer. at that interface, that's where the wells where the catfish have come out of line up. So it's a very small range, presumably. I know that scientists have been looking for these blind cats a couple of times. There was a set of studies or surveys done in the late 1970s, early 1980s, where scientists went and they surveyed, let's say, three, four dozen wells across the aquifer. At that point, they found blind cats in just a few of those wells. I think like three out of 40 some odd wells that they tested had cats coming out of it. There was another set of studies more recently, kind of 2020s or so, where again, they surveyed about 50 some odd wells and found three or so that produced blind cats. So they don't occur out of all the wells, just some of them. And most of the ones that they have found line up along that bad water line, which pretty much goes right under the heart of the city of San Antonio.
Well, that's really interesting. So then does the Fish and Wildlife Service believe that they don't exist in those other parts of the aquifer, or that there are so few of them that they simply don't come up in the wells? Or do they just not have access to the other wells to see whether they're there or not?
There's definitely an access issue. Humans can't get to that part of the aquifer. We can't go there and look around and see what that habitat looks like and see the fish swimming around in the water. So all that we can know comes out of those groundwater wells. And wells are drilled all over the place. There are, dare I say, hundreds of groundwater wells punched into the Edwards Aquifer that pull water out of that system. Most of those wells are privately owned. Nobody's looking for catfish that come out of them. Although, like from the very early detections of this species, it was just noted as essentially a curiosity that we drilled a well and there's fish coming out of it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it is a very challenging environment to come up with good baseline information because of that access issue, because of kind of private landowner concerns, because that even where we have wells that we do sample with some regularity, fish don't always come out of them. So even in wells where fish have been detected, they're not detected all the time. So it's some combination of rarity, of detectability, of just the challenge of us being able to observe that environment. So the short story is, we don't actually know how big their range is, what their population size is, or how they go about their business day to day. All we know is that sometimes catfish come out of a well.
Obviously, that presents just a lot of fun visuals to think about. I guess not for the fish, but
they don't always come out of the well's hole.
Yeah. And it's fascinating just hearing you talk about where these catfish species are, where wells have been drilled to that depth versus other depths all over the Edwards Aquifer. Can you talk a little bit about that baseline issue? Because for a species that you can observe, whether it's an endangered migratory bird or a red fox, you can send scientists out into the field to do field studies and observe, okay, well, you know what? We lost another couple of red foxes and that population group continues to dwindle. Or it doesn't seem like there are as many birds migrating back up into Texas or the United States. And you can compare data year over year, and you have some idea of what the overall population is at the present, regardless of what it might have been in the past. It seems to me that that is a huge problem if you're going to be listing this kind of species under the Endangered Species Act. We don't have the ability, from what I'm hearing from you, to really establish that baseline. We don't know whether there's just like this massive school, I guess, of these blind cats in other parts of the Edwards Aquifer where they're just totally happy and there are millions of them in all of these other places that we're not looking. So how is the Fish and Wildlife Service getting to its conclusion? Do you see any sort of scientific issues with how they're getting there? I know that, you know, we were talking a little bit before we started recording that they've reopened or at least had reopened, over December and January, the comment period for the proposed listing decision. So maybe they're taking in new evidence. Maybe they're thinking about these issues a little bit more. But can you talk a little bit more about the problems of establishing a species baseline?
So listing decisions under the Endangered Species Act are required to be made on the basis of the best available science. So they are not to take into consideration other kinds of factors like economic impact or pain and suffering Sure. on us humans. It's really supposed to just be on the basis of the science. So having good science is obviously a really important part of this process. Here, we don't have very much information or facts, let alone science. I think that poses a problem because in that information gap, we as scientists, we as humans tend to want to fill in the gaps with our professional opinions. And that story kind of plays out in the history of the Fish and Wildlife Service considering what to do with these two blind cat species over the last 40 years or so. These blind cats have been considered for listing for about 40 years. The service has taken up the question repeatedly since about the 1980s. Okay. Early in that history of consideration, the professional opinion was that we drilled a few holes in the aquifer. We found some blind cats coming out. Well, there must be a lot of fish in the aquifer. Like there must be tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of fish in the aquifer. They must be abundant down there if our small samples, our little pinhole pricks in the aquifer are producing that many specimens. Certainly there must be a lot down there. Fast forward till today, that story has been kind of flipped on its head. Now the story is, oh, we don't see very many of these catfish. We only collect them sometimes when we look in these wells and not all the time. And they're not found in all of the wells that we look in. They must be very, very rare. They must be amongst the rarest fishes in the world. I think that was a statement made by one of the Fish and Wildlife Service biologists. So there's a lot of daylight between the original kind of scientific opinion about the population size of these blind cats and present day, which is fine, except that we also don't have any more better informative information that really like warrants a complete flip of that story.
For me, something that really struck me about the proposed listing, and I have to admit, I have not read all species listings, but in this particular one, they use the word assume a lot. I mean, they take data from, I guess, other similar fish and then assume it must apply to these fish. And so I didn't count the number of times they used the word assume or similar words, but it was many. And that struck me as potentially problematic as the service completes the listing and possibly defends it in court.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Anne, what do we do under the Endangered Species Act when we have an issue with the availability of science generally, right? Is there a problem with the lack of data overall? Or do you just say, oh, well, we have some data, so that is therefore the best available science, right? It's not the best science. It's not something that's 100% scientifically defensible, right? It's the best available science. That's the standard for using this kind of data in a listing decision. Are there any problems there?
Well, I mean, certainly that's the way I think the agencies have generally approached these things over the years. But as you said, Daniel, it's typically been with species that there's actual firsthand study, observational data, even very difficult to find species like the spider in Texas, the bone cave harvestman that lives in caves. They've still got people who've actually studied the spiders and have, you know, fairly good observational data around that. And here, it just strikes me that it's quite different and perhaps quite unusual. I don't know how many species have been listed that humans can't observe at all in their natural habitat. But we've certainly seen a court relatively recently, and Amanda, I think we talked about this last fall, kind of be willing to scold at least the National Marine Fisheries Service about its overly conservative assumptions in its approach to protected species management. It's clearly something that opponents, and presumably there are a number who may want to challenge this, would want to zero in on and will, I expect.
So let's jump forward and imagine that these species are actually listed, right? We're still waiting to see what the administration is going to do. It might not want to finalize a listing during an election year. That could be one consideration. But let's just go ahead and imagine that the administration finalizes this listing and these two species are protected from take. I think that is one of the most powerful restrictions in environmental and natural resources law, the Endangered Species Act prohibition on take, which includes a lot of intentional actions like harassing endangered species or killing or hunting endangered species, generally not recommended on the podcast that you go out and do those things. But take is also defined as harm. So, Anne, Amanda, what are the effects of a listing decision? What are the effects of the take prohibition and what constitutes harm under the Endangered Species Act? Just simple questions.
Well, I mean, as you said, Daniel, the Endangered Species Act under Section 9 makes it illegal to take an endangered species, which includes harm like pulling blind catfish up from their habitat, resulting in their death, whether it's on the way to the top or once they get there and are extracted from their habitat. And so the implications of that, you know, I think are twofold. I mean, it's if someone is concerned that their actions are going to result in illegal take of endangered species, they can apply to the Fish and Wildlife Service for a permit allowing take that is not being done purposefully, but is incidental to an otherwise lawful activity. And so that would be one option if the folks who operate wells feel that they have the potential to violate Section 9. That's one way to get a safe harbor from ESA's provisions. And then the other way is if they need a federal permit to do something, then the federal agency would be required to consider the impacts of whatever action it's taking on the catfish and potentially to address those. And that also can result in protections from the take prohibition in the Endangered Species Act. So it's permitting and process.
And I think that's kind of what's interesting about the Endangered Species Act. Walking around or driving my car, I'm not worried about obtaining an air permit for my air emissions, right? I'm breathing CO2 now. I don't need to track my greenhouse gas emissions as an individual. But under the Endangered Species Act, I could need to operate a well. Maybe I live in rural Texas above the Edwards Aquifer and I enjoy using a well. That's how I get my water. That's how I take my showers. And so if these species are listed, then I am prohibited from extracting those species incidentally, until I obtain that incidental take permit, right? Otherwise, I'm potentially risking enforcement.
Right. I mean, I think that's the possibility. Section 9 of the ESA is an outright prohibition. Obviously, it's up to the individual whether to seek a permit to allow incidental take. But as you say, there's a risk of enforcement, always also a risk of a citizen suit under the Endangered Species Act. Citizens are able to sue directly to enforce the provisions of the act in the case of take. Of course, that's a pretty heavy lift because they have to have proof that there is take. And so they would need to have been able to come on somebody's property and know what's going on with a well in this particular instance.
Yeah, I would say be good to your neighbors, at least for the foreseeable future, if you're out there in San Antonio.
Yeah, I think there's another facet to this. So in articulating its reasons for wanting to list these species as endangered, the Fish and Wildlife Service has basically identified only one threat to their population, and that is the threat of mortality from use of these groundwater wells. It is the only thing that is influencing their population. And if this listing goes through, the position of the Fish and Wildlife Service will be that this groundwater use, at least at present day levels, is contributing to the extinction of these species. It is driving the trajectory of their populations toward extinction. If they didn't think that, they wouldn't be able to list. So a listing would mean that they think that groundwater pumping at least today's levels is driving those populations toward extinction. Okay. You can also get a permit for some of those kinds of takes, except you can't get a permit if it would jeopardize the continued existence of the species. And so here, the dependence on that one sole source of threat being the present day pumping levels in the aquifer or from the aquifer, driving that species towards extinction, really means that it's going to be very difficult for the agency to authorize continued pumping.
So that's really interesting. So while
continued pumping, like full stop.
Yeah. So while a Section 10 incidental take permit is theoretically available, mm-hmm. right? Assuming you can meet the criteria for issuance on the front end. What you're saying is you couldn't even meet those criteria. You might not even get to, you know, the NEPA review of right. your farmhouse well pumping, Which is so interesting to think that you would have to go through.
The only way to fix the problem is to pump less.
Yeah.
So for San Antonio to get its water from some other place than the aquifer below its feet. It's a really provocative situation, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's very provocative. And to me, it kind of underscores the lack of data that the Fish and Wildlife Service actually seems to have. Because would you tell a large municipality, I'm sorry, you just can't use the water source you're sitting on, even though we don't really know how many fish are down there or exactly what is going on with them? I mean, it's almost like they're saying, kind of, yeah, you know, we're doing a lot of guesswork, we're making a lot of assumptions. And because there's no other threat to the fish, they must be under duress and the wells are the only apparent cause. So, yeah, the notion that they could suggest that the pumping has to stop without knowing really for sure what's going on with the fish is a little dramatic.
You know, that brings up my final set of questions for you both. And that is, what are some of the broader impacts of a listing decision here? It strikes me that there are going to be some immediate effects on the residents of San Antonio. But I also think that this would be a pretty controversial listing decision. Again, that may be why they opened it up for comment again. But there are only something like 30 or 40 comments on this listing decision. It doesn't seem like this has caught the attention of the public yet. So yeah, so what are some of those broad impacts? I think this is just a fascinating set of facts that really could have some implications for the Endangered Species Act and the criticism that every once in a while is directed in its direction.
Well, you know, just from a legal perspective, one thing that occurs to me is that, you know, historically, well, not even historically, as recently as the early 2020s, you know, there's been litigation over the constitutionality of the Endangered Species Act. There was litigation in Texas over the constitutionality based on the listing of the Bone Cave Harvestmen. There was a relatively recent late 2010s case in Utah over the Utah prairie dog. The basic argument being that the ESA exceeds Congress's authority under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution when it comes to species that are located only in one state. Courts have consistently, ultimately, even though in the Utah case, initially the district court ruled in favor of the plaintiffs there, but they got overturned by the 10th Circuit. So consistently, the government has won that courts have been willing to say, even for species that occur only in one state, there's a rational basis to believe that the overall regulatory scheme constitutes an essential part of a regulatory scheme that in aggregate substantially affects interstate commerce, bringing it under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. My mantra that is proven right time and time again, and it's not only my mantra, is bad facts make bad law. So I wouldn't be surprised, even though there were only 30 comments on this listing, for someone to challenge the service if it's finalized and try to start to raise these issues again, especially with the current Supreme Court that is showing great willingness to revisit kind of longstanding basic principles under these major environmental statutes. Who knows what would happen with that down the road, but it does seem like it would be potentially something that could come up. And it's interesting, Amanda, you probably know better than I, but I've seen a statistic that actually 70% of listed species live only in one state.
I haven't seen that, but I don't dispute it. That seems about right to me. I mean, they are endangered. If they were everywhere, it wouldn't be an issue.
Yeah. If this issue goes up again, you know, it could have real significant implications if any courts feel the need to revisit it. Now, you know, I suppose, Daniel, as you're suggesting, maybe there's something different about this particular species because it is so isolated from human existence, except for the wells. I don't know, Amanda, can you think of any other species that are this isolated from humans? I mean, even the spider, like people can go into caves and study them. And
yeah, I mean, these blind cats have been synonymized with like the species that are around deep sea vents where you need fancy deep sea submersibles that might implode to go and see them. This is the only species that I'm aware of that nobody has ever seen its habitat mm-hmm. ever.
Because even the salamanders that live in the aquifer, they come closer to the surface, right?
they come to the surface naturally. Mm-hmm. They come out of spring outlets, which is kind of akin to coming out of a groundwater well. But, you know, they also live underground in those water-filled cavities in the rock. We don't see their habitat there, except in a couple places where those cavities are big enough for humans to get into and also connected to the surface that we can worm our way down into some of those subterranean pools. Mm-hmm. But still, we've seen them there. So these catfish, they're under pressure a quarter mile deep. It's impossible for us to get down there, at least directly. Very interesting stuff. Like, a lot of Endangered Species Act compliance has to do with understanding the species in their habitat. Here, we have almost no way of really knowing what their habitat is, how they use it, where they are, where they go, what they do when they're down there. All we know right now is what we can infer from what the animals look like themselves, from their physical morphology, which is wild, which is a lot of inferring. And therein lies the problem. Is that speculation? Is that, even if it's speculation by scientists, and this is, you know, this is well-meaning speculations. It's our desire to, like, kind of look for analogies to apply what we know in, you know, at least on the surface, similar circumstances to this obviously unique set of species and a unique habitat. But being special on its own isn't a listing criteria. Like, there has to be some demonstration, I think, some science that suggests that the species are trending toward extinction because of X, Y, and Z factors. Right now we have a factor, groundwater pumping, where we know that sometimes we get catfish out. None of the catfish that have come out of these wells have survived more than, I think, a few days at the surface. So the presumption is if they are expelled from the aquifer, they die. Okay. But we don't know how many are down there, how good they are at dealing with the fact that they live in that pressurized environment, that sometimes they get expelled to the surface. We just don't know.
And I suppose, you know, that really is the heart of the problem. I mean, looking at it from the other side, right, folks will say, well, the Endangered Species Act was enacted to protect any species that met the criteria for listing. And we're supposed to use best available science. And we know they're there. And we're using the best science that's available, given the isolation of their habitat. And so why don't they deserve protection as much as the grizzly bear, you know, or whatever other species is more observable? Probably some folks perceive a real tension between not having information, but still knowing there's a species that we know is impacted in some way by human incursion into their habitat.
It's a real tough question.
It's an interesting conundrum.
And the way that you phrase that, Anne, it seems like you could maybe say that, the hard data that we have is the best available science. And then the assumptions that we are necessarily making to make judgment calls about, you know, the species and its habitat and how populous it is, those are all agency decisions. That's, you know, we're going to bracket that apart from the hard data and say that the agency has made a set of rational assumptions by looking to comparison species. So maybe that's a defense strategy here.
Yeah. I mean, I think the problem is it's all an assumption. Like, there's no, you know, pretty much all of their findings are based on assumptions. And that kind of very conservative approach to species protection is maybe getting a good deal of pushback these days.
And again, like, as I mentioned before, like, the agency's posture about that speculation part has gone completely in the opposite direction.
And how did they explain that change from, oh, a few fish means there must be a lot, to, oh, a few fish means there must be hardly any left?
Well, they don't really. And that's a problem, too.
I think that that's going to be a litigation problem, too, when when a court asks under Encino Motorcars and a few other cases, you're required to explain that sort of shift in agency policies and agency conclusions about the facts. So that'll be interesting to read if we ever get to that point.
Yeah.
Well, any further conclusions? Our office has been really fun.
Well, you know, one other interesting legal thing we could mention is the question of standing, ultimately, if anyone is to challenge, if it's listed, or even in a listing challenge, how anybody's going to show injury in fact. sufficient to maintain a lawsuit, even a citizen suit challenge ultimately. Typically, in environmental challenges, folks can show interaction with the species, interaction with the habitat, those kinds of things. And that certainly will be very difficult here. So not that creative arguments can't be made, but it seems like there's an extra layer of challenge to a litigant establishing standing for this kind of species.
And you're thinking about challenging an agency decision not to list the species, or then in the event of a listing, bringing a citizen suit against your neighbor on the grounds that take has occurred.
Yeah, or, or if a federal agency for some reason has to issue a permit for a groundwater well, like it's in a wetland and the Corps of Engineers has to issue a permit, somebody challenging their compliance with the act.
You know, if there is a listing decision, and then like we just discussed, maybe if there's a decision not to list, it will be fascinating to see the kinds of arguments that people make to establish their own connection with this species that is way down in the hole, so to speak.
And if it is listed, it'll be interesting to see what water management folks do, given the implications.
I feel like if this gets listed, it sets up a pretty, I don't know, like titanic conflict, kind of like the Tellico Dam and the spike days, like at the beginning of the Endangered Species Act story. It's kind of like that showdown, because there aren't too many ways to mitigate the social disruption of that listing.
I think it's even more extreme than the Tellico Dam situation. I mean, obviously, Tennesseans wanted more power. Here, you have an ongoing day-to-day action of withdrawing from the aquifer that has been in place for decades, right? Who knows how many people rely on the Edwards Aquifer for their drinking water, whether that's through, you know, a water system or a municipality or on their own land or whatever it is. Like they already have wells. They already are pumping water out of the aquifer, and then take prohibitions come clanging down through Section 9. It's going to be really interesting.
It's going to be epic. Yeah.
Is this the type of occasion that, you know, the infamous God Squad?
That's right. We haven't even talked about the God Squad. Maybe not on this podcast before ever. So, Anne, real quick, what is the God Squad and what would it need to do here to keep San Antonio hydrated?
Well, I mean, there's a mechanism in the act, just to very much simplify it, that basically allows a committee of folks to kind of let the species go, you know, if the listing is too problematic. I have to confess, I can't remember all the magic words because it's
so rarely
I can't
used.
Remember if it's ever been done. I think it's been convened maybe, but was never came to any conclusion. Maybe once. I'm not Amanda may know, because I know she's a geek on the history of the Endangered Species Act, but I mean, it's never actually done anything. But there is an out mechanism, and maybe fish versus a water supply for the city of San Antonio would be an occasion.
There's also the possibility of just straight out congressional action to not list or to remove it from the possibility of listing. I don't know if that's an even like more shot at the moon than a God Squad convention. But
well, we've seen Congress do that before, right? With wolves and other things off and on. So that might be more likely than the God Squad.
Well, there's plenty to watch and talk about. Amanda, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's so fun to have you here. Obviously, we enjoy any time we get to spend with you. I was thinking about how I could describe you, by the way, in the introduction. And I just kept thinking of, you know, that line from Ghostbusters, like, who you gonna call? Well, Amanda Glenn is who you should call if you have endangered species questions. But then I thought the Ghostbusters, like, they stop the ghosts, they take them. And you're not out there taking species. You're studying and helping companies understand how their projects interface with the Endangered Species Act and its protected species. You're not out there taking species. We just want to be clear about that.
Not without a permit.
That's right. And always incidentally.
Always incidentally.
So thank you so much, Amanda, and always great to have you. We'll see you soon. Thank you to Emily for all the amazing work she does with the podcast to make us sound better than we deserve. And thank you most of all to our listeners. We will talk with you soon.